Florida Association. So, Ben, thank you very much.
Thanks, Becky. Okay, cool. Morning, everyone. Thanks for coming, giving up weekends. I'm most impressed. That's the title of the event today, the history of schools, present and future. Although you can see I deliberately sort of took some trouble to put the logo in twice. I pinched it myself from the publicity material, because for me personally, although Becky's quite right that I was asked to sort of look at this idea of the history of classroom, I'd like to, as usual, subvert the brief. They always give me this slot, or the end slot. I think it's on the basis of either he's a sort of visionary speaker, or he can't do much damage at one end or other of the programme. As usual, I'm going to slightly subvert the brief in a way which I hope will be helpful to everybody here. Because I do think that one of the really, really important features that we've got today is the thing that we know we all have, but we can so rarely exploit, which is that the history community consists of academics who are specialist academic historians. It consists of history teachers, and of course both of those two communities are both historians and teachers to some greater or lesser degree. It also consists, certainly from the point of view of the AHA, of the young people, for example, in schools, the general interest historians, and I guess it represents those people out there who watch the BBC TV genealogy programmes and the Antiques Roadshow and all that sort of thing, the popular history as well. And it seems to me that there are opportunities there that we can sort of get hold of. To make what we do, I guess, even more sort of important and useful and attractive than it already is. So obviously that's the brief. I'll start with the point that it's a fairly broad brief, as you can imagine. The history classroom. There you go, Ben. So that's the sort of speaker's nightmare or dream, depending on your point of view. So I thought it might be quite interesting to actually start with a history classroom and let you go. Look, now don't worry, I'm not going to bring any children in. But I would like you to think, certainly those teachers who are out here, that you might want to sort of consider this. But perhaps some of you, apologies. Some of you may sort of think, just love technology. Yeah. What I was trying to do was turn the sound up. Some of you, I think, may sort of think, ah, yes, I recognise this character. If you can't hear, don't worry, the sound isn't terribly important. Just watch the behaviour. Now, you'll notice I haven't specified which character. I don't think I need to. We won't have to watch him again. So there's not much doubt, is there, about the character I was sort of getting you to focus on. If you want to see the whole thing, maybe you've had enough just from that. If you want to see the whole thing, it's on the Teachers TV website. And it's part of a series about how a sort of behavioural specialist actually works with a teacher to manage the behaviour in the classroom. So in one sense, this isn't relevant. It just happened to be a history classroom, that was all. But I thought I think it gives a flavour of the history classroom. And I just wanted to make the point before we get any further, you know, that's not the worst class you're going to get, not by a long stretch, as a history teacher in an ordinary comprehensive school. On the other hand, that's also a very, very long way away from the best kind of teaching that you're going to see, with exactly the same class. When I say the best teaching, you know, I don't mean in a leafy suburb grammar school with pliant kids, or compliant kids, as it were. Yeah, that can be good teaching, but frankly, most of us could turn up tomorrow and teach well there. Yeah. What I'm saying is that, you know, that girl trying to teach that class, you know, she did a reasonable job. Some experienced teachers who've really cracked the game, so to speak, could do a fantastic job with that class. And so, you know, when we say the history classroom, you know, it's a bit like saying Germany, you know, with its population of millions and millions. And do we mean upper class or middle class? And do we mean male or female? Do we mean sort of, you know, straight or gay? You know, I mean, these are all the things that the history classrooms don't come in one size packs, just the same way that lecturers don't sort of stand there and have the same class in history, sort of their degree courses all over the country as well. So I just wanted to make that point. The second thing is that, you know, by and large, history teaching is reasonably strong. Mike is around here somewhere, the HMI for history. He'll tell us the latest results. Oh, there you are. Sorry. You had a jacket on earlier.
I know.
So he can tell us the final score, so to speak, on Ofsted data coming through. And, you know, obviously that's one way of measuring the quality of what's going on. But, you know, we have to accept that the position of history as a subject in schools is far from comfortable. Most history teachers here, you know, will recognise a situation where we are increasingly sort of under pressure in terms of curriculum time, for example. And, you know, most subjects have believed that they haven't got enough time. And history certainly is right there. You know, can you imagine looking at the national curriculum and saying, oh, brilliant, you know, I've got to teach every damn thing that's ever happened to any bugger under the sun, yeah, and I've got 1 hour a week to do it. Yeah, that sounds like fun, doesn't it? Yeah, so it does require some pretty creative thinking. Yeah, so teachers aren't out there doing sort of what might appear to be fairly weird stuff, you know, out of some sense of how perverse can I be today? Strangely, that doesn't actually motivate most history teachers. You know, what they're trying to do is to get at the character that you've just seen in a way that somehow speaks to him. Because I'd like you to just ponder that character. Sorry, I'll go back one. That character, you know, with his little key ring and that sort of thing. In fact, let's just look at him for a second. I thought I'd close them. Perhaps not. Maybe not. Okay. He, I felt, you might have thought, oh my God, I wouldn't want to teach him. But actually, he wasn't so bad. I mean, you know, he's not like he was the spawn of Satan or anything like that. Yeah? He was quite a biddable chap, really. He wasn't causing any trouble. Yeah? She left him alone, he left her alone. Yeah, that was more or less his coping mechanism. I do wonder, but you know, kids are actually rather good at reading the signs. How do I stay out of trouble? This is why I suspect, you know, 10% of kids manage to get through the entire school system illiterate. Actually, if you think about it, that's a phenomenal achievement. Yeah, to go from 5 to 16 and still not be able to read and write at the other end is an enormous achievement in double bluffing, in fobbing you off, in managing your you think you're managing their behaviour, right. Yeah, it works both ways, guys. Yeah. So actually, you know, I'm thinking a character like that, I think we could win him. His little mate next door, was reasonably engaged, actually, when you start, especially with the cretin next to him, sort of trying to distract him as much as he possibly could. Yeah? So, you know, maybe there are things that we can do. And, you know, let's be brutally honest about it. He clearly couldn't see any connection between himself and an Anderson shelter. What the hell's that got to do with me? Yeah. In fact, he wasn't even interested enough to ask that question. Yeah. Because he just couldn't see that it had anything to do with him. And this, I guess, is really what I'm saying, is that we as history teachers are at the cusp, in a sense. I think we have a terrific opportunity, but we also have a terrific problem. And the opportunity is that history teaching, generally speaking, is in good shape technically in many ways. There are lots and lots of well-trained, well-taught history teachers out there. There are lots of good resources. There are skilled people. There are support networks and that sort of thing. And maybe the next stage on is to get the kids to understand why it matters. Yeah? Why it's important for them to do this stuff. And I would suggest that that's an area that we are, as history teachers, where we are under-resourced. And I would also suggest quite strongly that that's an area where you as the OG community, you know, could really help us out. And it's a two-way street. Clearly, the history teachers have got to make the time and the effort, find the time somewhere, God knows where, to try and connect with what is happening at sort of the HE level, among other things. And similarly, you know, you have some really, really powerful things. I'm sorry for calling you assets, but I couldn't think of a better a better phrase in the time available. Okay, so you know, just to put this in a little bit of a rather than the conversational context I've just been given. Terry over there at the back there, Terry Hayden has did a report for QCA. On pupil perceptions of history, and forgive me, Terry, if I'm sort of playing fast and loose here. I don't think I am, but the long and the short, there are a few things that came out of it, and you know, if I could just sort of rapidly get to the heart of it, which was that by and large, kids liked history. They rated it. They rated their teachers. Yeah, so that was great news. Terrific news. It was about 2,000 kids, was it?
1700,
right, okay. Yeah. Stay with me, Terry, stay with me. Okay, now, what we also found, of course, is that, or what we know, is that two-thirds of kids give up history at 14. Yeah? I'd say the worst bit about that is that over half of them, if the various bits of research are anything to go by, over half of the kids who give it up think history is really good. So, history, that's brilliant, yeah, I'm giving it up. Okay? And what is driving that appears to be this idea that history is great, but it's not relevant. It's got nothing to do with me. Yeah, I'll take it up again as a hobby when I retire. Yeah, or I'll watch history films. Yeah, oh, Time Watch, great, that'll do. Yeah, don't need to do GCSE history. So, you know, and I'm not saying for 1 second that history isn't relevant. The point, of course, is that you know, what we're not doing is getting the kids to see why it's relevant. We may see why it's relevant, but clearly they are not getting that message. So as well as doing what we do, I think one of the things that we've got to connect with is this idea of explaining why it matters, you know, why it is important to do that. And we are up against some pretty formidable problems, what I characterise as the new educational landscape. And this is sort of, you know, each week we have a long-term initiative, it seems to me. those of you in the classroom will know this, don't they? I'm not quite sure what this week's long-term priority is, but it does seem to be an initiative a week. So you've got, you know, Every Child Matters, or we've got the, you know, Aim Higher, or, I mean, you name it, it's out there. In fact, I was looking at something not so long ago where that there's a specialist unit to help increase sort of access to higher education for non-traditional groups, and they recently produced a summary of the initiatives going on 14 to 19 for academics. Okay, it's quite well written. The thing is, it's a summary of educational initiatives 14 to 19. It's 25 pages long. 25 pages is the summary of the initiatives that are out there. Now, by the time you've read the summary, to be honest, you could have implemented half of them. Yeah? And this is the kind of thing that we're up against. And of course, one of the problems is that they're driven by this idea that somehow education's got to be relevant, whatever that means. Yeah? But relevance is the buzzword. And relevance is increasingly becoming a kind of shorthand for not academic subjects. Okay? So, for example, if I take just a little headline from the Daily Mail there. Drop middle class academic subjects, says schools advisor. Now, of course, in the Daily Mail, schools advisor is equivalent to what, paedophile Nazi? But you know, the thinking there is still sort of very, very worrying for a lot of us who actually care passionately about these subjects. What we're seeing is kids, instead of doing subjects, what they're doing is project work. Yeah? Now, it can be good, but let's face it can be pretty awful as well. And it misses out some of the core things. And what we're seeing increasingly, particularly with the use of the internet, is project work in the sense of healthy eating. Yeah, so off they go and Google healthy eating. Fantastic, yeah? Of course, you know, if you Google healthy eating, the first site that comes up is McDonald's. Now, I don't have a problem with that if we actually capitalise on it and say, using your skills as a historian, why is that a crap result? But that's not happening. Yeah, that's not the thing that's actually taking place. So that's what we're up against. And I'm suggesting that you know, to try and address the issue, yeah, we've got to do the Lyndon Johnson thing. Okay, you know, Johnson always said about one particular individual, Hoover, wasn't it, that he'd rather have him on the inside of the tent pissing out. Yeah, and frankly, I think in schools, we as historians have been on the outside of the tent for some time. And I do feel that we have to start getting on the inside of the tent. One of our biggest problems in this whole relevance issue is that for long established reasons, fixed in the minds of managers, fixed in the minds of kids, is this idea that somehow maths, English and science are relevant, where subjects like history is not. Yeah. Now, you know, nothing could be more wrong. Yeah, nothing could be more wrong at all, but we've got to address that somehow. So for example, well, and these are four areas in which I think we might be able to engage and address that a little bit. So if we take the academic dimension, yeah, let's look at what some of these academics are doing. Okay, this is a marvellous book, in my humble opinion. It's called Sex, Science and Profits. He's an academic historian, okay? He's a microbiologist, but what he's really saying is that science is a construct, just like history. Okay? Now, there are several science, if there had been any science teachers in the room at this moment in time, I suspect we would have to pick them up off the floor at this point. Yeah. But the fact is that science has achieved this idea, it's relevant. Admittedly this is a slightly biased sample, but did anybody do any fractional distillation over the weekend? Okay. I'd like you to just think for a minute, when was the last time you used Pythagoras? And you can see what I'm getting at, can't you? The content of maths and science is just as much a pile of bollocks as anything else. Yeah, forgive my French, but this is the sort of thing that really rattles my cage. It is not relevant. The content of history isn't relevant, except in the sense that you might say some kind of cultural buying in. Yeah, our content is the way in which we get the kids to engage with the things that we do. We get people to think. And all subjects do that. But I would argue that, you know, they ought to be on a level playing field in the way that they're allowed to do so. But they're not. We have this idea somehow that maths and science are relevant. Okay? Now, I would argue passionately that there's no way that they are more relevant than history. certainly in terms of the processes, the intellectual cognitive processes that we actually work through. You know? And this book, I think, is an excellent example of that precise process. He makes the point, this is a lovely, I will just digress slightly, where he was saying that, you know, if we want, that one of the justifications, allegedly, for science being so core to the curriculum is that it develops this entrepreneurial ideal that we need. Yeah, you know, if content is related to the entrepreneurial process, shouldn't we all be teaching them wig making? Yeah? Richard Arkwright, founder of the Industrial Revolution, was a wig maker. Clearly, that's where he got it from. Yeah, it's the same logic, isn't it? The same stupid logic that's there, that somehow the content is the thing that frees. Yeah? And I'm not one of these guys who says just teach skills. Absolutely not. But I do feel very strongly that you know, you can't separate the two out. And what history has argued as its greatest asset is the way in which it gets you to think and to engage with the world around you as much as anything else. Other areas. John Tosh has written this fabulous book, Why History Matters. Every teacher should have a copy of that. Yeah. If nothing else, just for the Year 9 propaganda evening when we try and get sort of people in for options evening, Freudian slip there, when they choose their GCSE courses. Yeah. So, you know, the academic community is already giving us help in this respect. We've got the History and Policy Unit producing some marvellous bits of stuff, and with a regular slot in BBC History magazine. Every month there is a sort of double page spread on the historical relevance of something or other, some current topic or issue. There's the wonderful George Mason History News Network, and this is a website dedicated to just harvesting information from the web, news media events from the web about sort of history-related issues. And so there have been some fabulous debates, for example, about whether or not Vietnam is relevant to Iraq. Yeah, exactly what the sort of relationship between the present and the historical situation is. And certainly my experience has been that most academics, when teachers sort of do make contact with them, are very willing to help, you know, especially where their sort of expertise is directly relevant. And I've just come across this recently. This is the data archive which is held at Essex University, UK Data Archive. And these are just simply databases. And behind every one of these is an academic or a team of academics. A lot of these, for example, are oral history collections, that sort of thing. And I suppose what I'm getting at is that for most school teachers, probably within 15 miles, there is an academic who, in his or her head, has this fantastic resource that the kids could go, God, blimey, that's good. Yeah. And Yeah, there's no point pretending it doesn't take time and effort to try and do something about it, but it's there. Yeah. And if you were looking for that local dimension particularly, or that quirky off-the-wall dimension, yeah, I suspect there's an academic near you somewhere who can provide that. I'm just conscious of time, so I'm going to plow on. The second area is the cultural dimension. Yeah. When we think of archives, usually we think of dusty shelves and scary archivists. Okay? But if you actually look at what's going on in the archive world at the moment, then you know there are some phenomenal things happening. Some of you may have come across, for example, British Libraries. There we go. I think it's this is the British Library's Turning the Pages technology. Yeah, getting kids to see, this is obviously a Quran. Yeah, and just as a cultural artifact as much as anything else. But I mean, they're not going to go to the British Library. Even if they live in Camden, they're not going to go down to the British Library and go and look at this thing. Yeah, but what technology is bringing to us through archives? Yeah, there's no point in having the technology if the content is non-existent, or worse still, if the content is rubbish. Yeah, but the National Archives, the British Library, video conferencing, you know, those sorts of things. If you go to the National Archives website, particularly the education website, which is the learning curve, you will see podcasts where academics have done sessions with sixth form students, for instance. Yeah. Now, you know, I would argue that the cultural sector has a huge amount to offer us here, and they themselves are under considerable pressure to broaden the range of people, get beyond the white middle classes, essentially, in terms of who are actually using your collections. Now, clearly, history has got to be a potential pathway. And, you know, if we could start looking at Islam in the sense of a society as a civilization that produces these fabulous, beautiful artifacts in the context of a flourishing civilization, as well as, should we say, the more negative stereotypes and connotations and associations that we see, then we start to get what we as historians are good at, which is a nice, complicated, confusing, baffling picture. Yeah, I'm always deeply concerned if I see a history lesson where the kids are thinking, yeah, I get this. We should see history lessons where the kids are thinking, what the hell's going on? Because that's what people at the time were thinking, isn't it? How many people here are sitting thinking to themselves, Iraq, oh, that was easy. Yeah? Only George Bush, need I say more? Yeah? So, you know, one of the points about history and history teachers is the way that we do confuse the hell out of the kids in a constructive sort of way. Yeah? And it's important to do that. The idea that, you know, different groups, different societies, even different classes actually look at each other. You know, what better way could there be to start that process than to look at each other's artifacts? To listen to each other's songs? To read each other's books? To watch each other's TV programmes? Yeah? It's not a bad starting point, is it? And it's all there. And I would argue that if we don't do anything else in terms of educating our kids in any subject at all, I think if kids come out knowing, understanding one thing, I would like it to be the idea that knowledge changes, that knowledge is provisional. You know, that at one point we thought the world was flat, and then we changed our minds. Yeah, and I think really very, very powerfully that, you know, the idea that knowledge changes is something that, you know, whether as historians, I'm amazed how often I talk to other teachers of other subjects who sort of say, well, you know, obviously history's not going to change, is it? Because it's finished. I mean, how sad is that? You know, that clearly in many other subject areas, the content is clearly fixed. Yeah? You'll gather by now, I enjoy taking swipes at science, and sadly, you know, for most kids' school experience, they see science as an area where the content is fixed. But that is their experience. I mean, it's totally wrong, but you know, there is the knowledge, there's the science. Yeah. Now, what could be more fluid than science in terms of, you know, what we understand as knowledge? Except maybe history, of course. There is also a commercial dimension. Sorry, Alf, I'm eating into your time here. I'll finish in a minute. There is that commercial dimension as well. Yeah, there's the actual the commercial value of historical content. Think about TV and film. Yeah. Okay, some of it is appalling historically. But actually, you know, my view is, I'm not one of these people who thinks that the Hollywood films should be accurate. Yeah, I am one of these people who thinks that kids should understand why they're not. Yeah. So, you know, U-571 was a classic example, wasn't it, where suddenly it was an American submarine that found it in the ship. Now, yeah, the Hollywood producers didn't do that just to piss off ex-Navy people. Yeah. What they did that for was to get bums on seats in American cinemas, and so they played fast and loose with the story. And understanding how and why the story is adapted for particular purposes and particular audiences, I would argue, you know, for the vast majority of kids who aren't going to become historians or teachers or professionals in that sense, just understanding that process is something that is sort of valuable. And if we take similar idea, computer games, you know, we've seen the mega multi-million selling Medal of Honor series. Okay, just Google Medal of Honor, and you'll see. Basically, it's what they call a first-person shooter. Yeah. You've also seen the Assassin's Creed game, which is set in the Crusader period. Now, the interesting thing about these two games, clearly the narrative of the game is utter drivel, it's just fantasy. But what sells these games against their competitors, okay, is the quality, is the authenticity of the environment in which the action takes place. And I was speaking to a teacher not so long ago, he's a bit of an anorak, and he takes the kids to Anzio, okay, because the Italian campaign in the Second World War is his big thing. And he was telling me about this one particular time when a couple of lads climbed up to the top, sorry, not Anzio, Monte Cassino, climbed up to the top and sort of said, oh yeah, there's that, then. That's where the Germans were. I said, do you know all this? Medal of Honor. These kids have been there. Yeah, the site is accurate. Down to the last T. They get historians and archaeologists into that. Now, I think that's a pretty good way to sell the idea that the historian's skill set is worth something. Yeah? We're seeing manufacturing eroded all the time, aren't we? You know, it is the information economy that's sort of, we're told anyway, is the future here. And, you know, what historian doesn't practice research, analysis, evaluation, communication, and indeed fresh thinking? This was a fascinating little article I came across on The Guardian. And what he's saying is, you know, for fresh thinking, don't forget history. Yeah. What they were actually talking about here was the NHS, how to reform the NHS. But he was saying, actually, if you want some smart ideas, go back and look at the history. And obviously, if you want some rotten ideas, go back and look at the history as well. Yeah? It's not a template, it's not a pathway, it's not a blueprint, but surely it's better to be informed than just make it up as you go along. And finally, the dark side. I was listening yesterday as I was travelling down to Radio 4, and Al Murray, pub landlord. You might know who that is, but the kids will. Yeah, he's actually an Oxford history graduate, and he was waxing lyrical about the way in which history is used as a political weapon. Yeah, I'm now searching the playback bit of Radio 4 to find that bit so I can record that clip and use it, you know, sort of here and there. There are quite a few of these guys around. Mark Steele, you know, who also sort of engage in this. We've seen on the History News Network, there was a feature not so long ago about the behaviour of memorial museums. And this academic was looking at the visitor's book and expecting to see sort of situated, yeah, comments along the lines of, you know, never again and we must be vigilant and blah, blah, blah. And he was saying that he was completely shocked by the comments that were in there, which were things like, this would never have happened if more people had found Jesus. Yeah? Just disconnecting from what they'd actually seen in the first place and reconnecting something, which I would regard as spurious and inappropriate, to that. Now, the fact is that the dark side of the web is what this is all about. It's the ability for any nutter to publicise and disseminate. Now, that's always been around, hasn't it? What's different, I think, is the scale and extent of it. But I think what's also different is the way in which Google, in particular, has established a life and a reputation of its own. Okay, in our latest edition of Teaching History, I was just quoting from a bit of research that was done, where we asked some kids about any work that they've done recently, and we said, you know, did you use the internet? Yes. Did you use Google? And admittedly, it was a small-scale trial. It was only 20 students, I think, that we asked. 18 of them said that they'd, sorry, all 20 of them said that they'd used Google, okay, to find this particular answer. One of them was able to say which site he'd used, okay, and the rest of them said Google. And it's this idea that somehow Google is providing answers. They're just not seeing that Google is a portal. Yeah. So if you Google Martin Luther King, for instance, then one of the top sites that comes up is this, Martin Luther King, A True Historical Examination. Dig a bit deeper and you'll find that it's actually a neo-Nazi website run by an organization called Stormfront, which is a white supremacist organization. Okay? Now, I'm not sure which is the most sort of worrying aspect of it. Is it the content of this thing? Is it the fact that you can download flyers to pass out at your school? Is it the fact that they have deliberately used a web address, martinlutherking.org, because they know that kids look at that and say, oh, that looks legitimate? Okay? And the only defense about this sort of thing is a sound historical knowledge. Yeah? But this goes way beyond proper history, doesn't it? You know, this is perverted history being used as a political tool. Okay? And if we as historians were put on this earth for if there is any justification for why we torture our students in the classroom with how far do you trust source B, yeah, then surely this is what it's all about. This is what it's for. And of course the most worrying bit of the lot is the extent to which kids basically think, Google, there's the answer. 9 times out of 10, of course, they end up on Wikipedia. We haven't got time for that. So, my last point really. Sorry, I'll just. My last point really I'll take as a sort of slightly lighter note is that, you know, we are looking at at a future in which the importance of the past, I think, can't be underestimated. Yeah. One of my strongest arguments, I think, is that history stops you being thick. Now, these are not my slides. These are taken from a guy called Steve Molyneux, who's one of these sort of web gurus, as it were. But the fact that he has no interest in history whatsoever, and I'm taking this from a presentation that he made to a computers and learning conference in the Middle East somewhere, and yet that I would suggest that these things fit rather nicely with what I've just been talking about, the history classroom, for me, says it all. Thank you very much.
Ben, thank you. I kind of wish I'd podcast that as a guest of the HA for our website. I need to stand on that at some point.